This show is a Hopful Media podcast production. Wait. Don't skip this one. It's Trevor. I am here to tell you that this coming Saturday, February 8th, at 10 a.m. U.S. Eastern Time, I will be at the Intelligent Speech Conference. This is an annual event with many history podcasters or history-adjacent podcasters presenting on a wide range of topics, and this year's theme is deception. We've got Otto English from the books Fake Heroes and Fake History, the Fake History Hunter podcast, Wesley Livesay from History of the Great War, Robin Jamie from Totalis Rankium, Robin Pearson from History of Byzantium, and many other friends of this show. I will personally be speaking in 4 time slots with topics ranging from Darius the Great to early modern Zoroastrianism to the people who may or may not have written the books of the Bible. The whole event will be available for rewatch for 1 week after it ends. If you buy your tickets now, go to intelligentspeechonline.com and tune in this Saturday, February 8th at 10 a.m. U.S. Eastern Time. Again, that is intelligentspeechonline.com for this coming Saturday. I hope we see you there.
Big shout out to you for making it through the hectic holiday season. This new year, get clean, quality, pregnancy nutrient support off your to-do list, including Ritual's best-selling essential prenatal multivitamin, designed with 12 traceable key ingredients to support a healthy pregnancy. With big changes coming up, take the small steps now and start today with 30% off a 3-month supply at ritual.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia. This is episode 137. Who are you again? Again. Okay, so the new routine is off to a less than stellar beginning. I don't think this episode will be too late, but I spent like 3 hours trying to figure out what was wrong with my internet while finishing this episode. It turns out, I had disconnected a cable from my router while plugging in Christmas lights. So that's fun. Anyway, here we are at the turning of the age. Last time, King Seleucus joined his fellow Diadochoi in a last alliance against the forces of Antigonus Monophthalmos. Due in large part to the elephants Seleucus had acquired from the Mauryan Empire, Antigonus died at 80 years old on the battlefield, while his son, Demetrius, barely managed to escape with a tenth of their army. The Antigonid kingdom, once spanning almost all of Alexander's old empire, was reduced to a few islands nobody else had bothered to conquer yet. Ptolemy and Seleucus contested rule of Syria. Lysimachus added the northern and western half of Anatolia to his domain, while Seleucus took the east and the south. There's some debate about what exactly was going on in Cilicia, Lycia, and the rest of southwestern Anatolia, the area where the battle actually took place, but I'll deal with that another time. Cassander once again held authority over all of Greece and Macedon, and Ptolemy was beginning to make moves towards Cyprus. The war was not over. Demetrius had a few strongholds left and immediately started trying to harass Lysimachus, perceived accurately as his weakest opponent. But for the time being, the on-again-off-again wars entered a period of calm. This was aided in no small part by Demetrius and Seleucus forging a marriage pact, with Seleucus marrying Demetrius's own daughter, Stratonike. Remember back to the end of the Mauryan War, if both sides exchanged female relatives, especially daughters, they were treating as equals. If only one side sent a daughter to the other, the sender was seen as the lesser partner. Demetrius was now firmly the lesser. However, I'm actually not going to focus on family matters today, in part because there's just a lot to get through as we enter this new period of history. Way, way back, I did a version of this episode as Cyrus the Great wrapped up his conquests too, explaining what Persian culture and society was like in the broadest of terms. I'm going to do some of that today, but I'm in a bit of a weird position. We know who the Greeks and Macedonians are already. The Seleucid Empire is still quite new. Hellenistic rule in general is still pretty new. Alexander the Great didn't really do any state building, and the Diadochoi have been so focused on fighting that they've just barely started to scratch the surface. But the seeds are planted. So we begin with important caveats. A lot of what I'm talking about today didn't really mature into its fully developed form under Seleucus I Nicator. A lot of it won't even really get started until the reign of his son, Antiochus, who successfully led Demetrius away from the battle in the last episode. However, the basic outline that we have time for today was intentional from the start, often even going back to the general philosophy of Alexander the Great, especially within the Seleucid Empire, since Babylon was Alexander's city, and the Persians were his favored people as often as not. Unlike the episodes after Cyrus the Great took Babylon, I'm not going to talk about art and architecture very much today, because the Hellenistic period is its own artistic epoch, and that will have to get its own episode down the line. In terms of things like art, architecture, philosophy, mathematics, just know for now that there is a blending between East and West, but the changes that occurred in this period and the new styles that developed were fueled from a Greek basis. Instead, let's begin with an overview of the empire, because it's been a while since we really covered the whole thing, and I'm sure most of you who don't have Ian Ladyov's maps, link in the show notes, open at all times, have lost track of things by now. There's also some stuff we just haven't covered at all that I'll spend more time on soon. The Seleucid Empire, circa 300 BC, looked a lot like the Achaemenid Empire if you roasted it over hot coals for a few decades. Kinda the same shape, but shrunken and misshapen. We covered the eastern and western extremes recently. The border with Mauryan India now runs from around modern Kabul, along the Hindu Kush, and then out across the Gedrosian Desert to the Gulf of Oman. Modern Syria, if that is still a thing, as I release this within days of the fall of Bashar al-Assad, brought Seleucid rule to the Mediterranean. But although Seleucus claimed ownership, most of the south, called Coel Syria in this period, was occupied by Ptolemy. This is the region I generally refer to as the Levant, or Palestine and Phoenicia, including Judea, Samaria, Tyre, all of those places. That's Coel Syria. Basically anything between Damascus and the modern Saudi Arabian border. In part because they have the best recorded history of anybody in the region, and in part because they genuinely seem to be a historically significant outlier in as many ways as possible. The Jews of Judea were, in fact, an outlier here. You'll often see Judea as a blotch of Seleucid territory, surrounded on all sides by Ptolemy in maps for this period. That's because Jerusalem initially resisted Ptolemaic annexation. Like much of ancient Jewish history, we know this from Josephus, and although he doesn't state it, he implies that Samaria followed suit. As the story goes, Jerusalem was either angling for greater autonomy or leaning towards Seleucus when Ptolemy arrived in the area. Personally, and I think this idea has some basic merit in logic, I like to imagine that Judea looked at its own history and saw, well, when the Babylonians were coming, we tried to side with Egypt and Babylon conquered Jerusalem twice. And around the time of Artaxerxes II, they leaned towards Egypt and the Persians retook Jerusalem. So this time, maybe they just looked at the situation and said, no, we know how this works. If we side with Egypt, the big power in the east will take everything over. So we're going to just lean that way from the start. When he arrived, the king in Egypt acted as though he was going to pay his respects at the temple and offer sacrifices in accordance with the Jewish Sabbath, only for his guards to seize control of the city gates and let his army in as a surprise attack. Jerusalem fell almost instantly, allowing Ptolemy to claim the region undisputed. Of course, this is still a story about Jerusalem losing a conflict, which means it can only end in one way. The city was sacked, and hundreds, if not thousands, of residents of Judea and Samaria were deported to Egypt. Ironically, this had major knock-on effects for centuries to come. The deported Jews and Samaritans were granted all of the same rights and privileges as Greek and Macedonian settlers in Alexandria, and the deportee community thrived, especially after Ptolemy's successor, Ptolemy II, loosened the restrictions on traveling back and forth to Judea. Alexandria near Egypt became one of the great intellectual centers of Judaism, and remained such long after the Ptolemies and Jewish rule of Jerusalem faded into history. Just for reasons, it will be important to keep Judea in circulation as history goes forward. Back in our own story, though, the interior of the Seleucid Empire was largely unchanged from their Achaemenid predecessors. The system of satraps and satrapies was largely unaltered, though decades of war had given them greater autonomy than was typically enjoyed under the Achaemenids. The domestic provincial borders seem to have been largely unchanged as well. The biggest difference was that Persis, in particular, no longer had any special importance, and Susiana was in decline with the absence of direct royal patronage. Unlike the highly mobile Persian court of old, the Seleucids preferred a marginally more stationary capital, initially in Babylon to the detriment of southern Iran. It is the northern border where we see the most surprising changes. Or maybe not if you've been following references to these areas very closely. Technically, Seleucus was granted rule over eastern Anatolia in the settlement after Ipsus. In reality, that grant came with a big asterisk labeled, "If you can." The northeastern coast of Anatolia, gradually expanding inland to encompass most of Cappadocia and all of Armenia and the Caucasus, were the regions most neglected by Alexander the Great's conquests and the settlements of the Diadochoi. As a result, a lot of the old Persian nobility still held power there. And after all this chaos, they weren't about to just roll over and submit. Bithynia, Paphlagonia, Pontus, Cappadocia, Armenia, and the northern slice of Media that Alexander had declared Media Minor under the rule of Satrap Atropates all shrugged off Seleucid rule and resisted any sparsely documented attempts at reconquest. So in reality, Seleucus's share from the Battle of Ipsus was negligible in the north, making Syria all the more important. Just another thing to keep in mind for the time being. On the other side of the Caspian Sea, you really see the post-Achaemenid contraction. The northern Saka that the Achaemenid kings always listed as their subjects are definitively gone at this point, firmly cutting off Seleucid rule at the Jaxartes River. The Dahai Confederation, if anything, grew to become a threatening, independent, if disorganized power on the steppe in its own right, while the southern kings were busy. Khorasmia, a region that's always been a bit of a black box in the historical record, was now an independent kingdom as well between Seleucid Hyrcania and the Aral Sea. Many historians and archaeologists actually think they may have slipped out of Achaemenid control before Alexander. But the Alexandrian sources do reference Khorasmian submission. That submission did not carry over to Seleucus. That just leaves Sogdia, now the absolute fringe of Seleucid control, and Bactria on the northeastern front. Surprisingly, Bactria, of all places, became something of a Seleucid stronghold thanks to the influence of Seleucus's wife Apama, who he married in the mass wedding ceremony at Susa under Alexander's direction. That said, just because institutions and borders remained in existence doesn't mean that the system continued to function as it had originally under Darius and Xerxes. If you've been listening for that long, you know that it hasn't fully functioned that way in some time. We already know that under the later Achaemenids, more and more satrapies and governorate positions became dynastic rather than centrally appointed. Alexander, Antipater, Antigonus, Seleucus, and eventually his successors, did try to revert this a bit on the satrap level, though that too will eventually falter back to dynasticism. However, smaller regional units rapidly became more autonomous during the wars of the Diadochoi, and Seleucus did very little to change that. In part, I think this can be treated as realpolitik. He simply didn't have the military force or political capital to force top-down administration in every major city. It can also be seen as a partial consequence of his roots and many of his advisors' origins in Greece. At this point, Macedon has only been an imperial society for about 50 years. Culturally, a lot of their norms and values were still rooted in a small mountain kingdom. Likewise, the Greek ideal was still an autonomous city-state. And true to form, many new cities were founded and old cities remodeled on a Hellenistic city-state style of both government and social life. One of the most striking differences between writing about the Achaemenids compared to the Seleucids is that we hear much less about the satraps or even regional governors. Much of the action going forward will be focused on the actions and positions of specific cities. This was also tied into a new, or more accurately, revived phenomenon of the early Hellenistic period, the colony city. Often, these started as little more than military garrisons with big dreams. But before we get into all of these new building projects, we're going to take a quick break for an ad.
At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger, and you can get started now by saving when you join today. We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need, and you can work out your way on your time at any convenient location near you. Most open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save. Just $1 down, $15 a month. See Home Club for details.
But from Alexander's many, many Alexandrias down through the Roman period, Hellenistic rulers just loved establishing a new city and filling it with soldiers and a few civilians from back home. This created a heavily militarized diaspora population with no local loyalty beyond their new city and the king. Seleucus is credited with founding at least 17 cities, or at least refounding and rebuilding existing settlements on a Hellenistic model, often named after his father and/or son, as Antioch, his mother, Laodicea, or himself, Seleucia. One of these, Seleucia on the Tigris, was founded as a new palace capital for the dynasty, and Greco-Macedonian mirror to Babylon itself, just a few miles north of the ancient great city. Another, potentially the most important of them all, was Antioch on the Orontes in northern Syria, a sparsely populated region that had suddenly become the integral connection between the Seleucid home base in Babylonia and the Mediterranean. Perhaps most surprisingly, the city known commonly as Iconium in Bactria was another of Seleucus's most prominent foundations. Deep within the empire, and in his first wife's homeland, Iconium served to establish a new wave of urbanization in South Central Asia and gave the dynasty a military presence in the north. You've probably noticed that the military keeps coming up. Whether it's because there's not enough of one to enforce top-down rule, or because building it up is the point of all of these colonies. Mitchell Austin even calls the Seleucids a military monarchy in his chapter, The Seleucids and Asia. Militarism, conquest by the spear, was the Seleucid dynasty's only real claim to legitimacy for generations. And by the time they were well established enough to talk about precedence, they were already falling apart. Their gods were foreign, and a half dozen foreign kings all claimed Greek divine favor in the same way. So they lost that angle from the Achaemenids and Babylonians. They couldn't claim Ahura Mazda or Marduk as their divine patron. Unlike Cyrus the Great, Seleucus had no claim to being an eternal scion of kingship. He was the descendant of some middling nobility in a rural mountain kingdom. So Seleucid rule was military rule. The Seleucid king was a warlord in the truest sense. Carrying out warfare was the primary purpose of having a monarchy and an empire. Taxes went to the top to fund warfare. Colonies were built to supply soldiers. Roads were maintained for armies to march. That's part of why they engaged in so many urbanization projects across Mesopotamia and northern Iran, to establish a stronger military presence and cultural cachet from their Greek roots. Unlike Ptolemy and his successors in Egypt, there was no realistic way to enforce Hellenization of culture and still maintain basic military control. So the Seleucids didn't try. But the Seleucid army was built on the Macedonian model forged by Philip II, and the ruling class of Macedonian nobles still preferenced things from their Greek heritage. So these colony cities spread Hellenism through the simple soft power of being there and being in charge. And the objective hard power of being where the army was stationed. Even then, the Seleucid Empire was too large for Hellenization at nearly the same scale as Anatolia or Egypt, where the same number of Greek colonists had a much larger impact. Seleucid settlers were just too spread out in most of the empire. Instead, the general trend was for locals to take advantage of Greek practices they liked, such as ornate public bathhouses, and give them some local Mesopotamian or Iranian flair. Only in northern Syria, where cities like Antioch were the only major urban centers to ever exist, did Seleucid culture really dominate the scene. This system of military dominance and cultural interchange notably led to something of a Median resurgence. With Persepolis abandoned, Pasargadae reduced to little more than a local garrison, and Susa just ignored for reasons that nobody's ever quite been able to explain, Ecbatana became the major Iranian city once again. Median and Parthian horses and cavalry became integral to the Seleucid war machine early on. And in addition to old, relatively small urban areas like Ecbatana and Raga expanding, newly urbanized sites like Parthia's Hecatompylos became prominent and wealthy centers of Iranic, Persianizing Seleucid rule. The military dimension of all this even extended into political administration. It's not clear whether military commands like Kiliarch, the commander of 1,000 soldiers, doubled as political office, or the Seleucids reused their titles. But those military offices were used to describe roles like tax collector and local governor. Toward the end of his life, Seleucus even began adapting and exporting a version of the Achaemenid and Babylonian hatru system. Seleucid veterans and settlers were given plots of land called katoikoi, which were assessed for their tax value and assigned proportional military service requirements. Like the hatru in Babylonia, this rewarded soldiers for their service, placed a diaspora population of militant loyalty in key areas, and ensured the Seleucids' loyalists held lots of land. Seleucus just scrapped the chariot estates with these new settlements and applied expanding the property range for heavy infantry and pushing cavalry to the most prestigious role. That said, old chariot estates down in Babylon continued to exist, and scythed chariots keep popping up occasionally for the next 250 years. And finally, also stemming from the image of the Seleucids as military kings, a different public perception of kingship emerged under their rule. I've talked before about how the Achaemenid nobility placed prestige value on being able to avoid the public. The king would have to be seen occasionally to prove he still existed, and noblemen had to interact with soldiers to be effective generals. But overall, they limited their contact with the public and even their peers. To sit at the king's table was one of the highest honorifics granted by Persian rulers. Seleucus was a career soldier who had risen through the ranks rapidly as a young man, but spent decades constantly on the march, constantly fighting, and therefore constantly seen and interacting with his subordinates. Being a friend of the king was still prestigious under Seleucid rule, but it presented very differently. The Seleucid kings presented themselves as a two-way street, where they offered friendship and protection to the subjects, and the subjects offered the crown friendship and tribute. The Seleucid monarchy was thus a very different social order to the old Achaemenid system, and we will see how that plays out as the kings and their armies interact with the wider empire. Speaking of the Seleucid court, that brings me to a good stopping point to transition toward our next episode, a discussion of Seleucus and his family. Until then. If you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia. Wait. Don't skip this one. It's Trevor. I am here to tell you that this coming Saturday, February 8th, at 10 a.m. U.S. Eastern Time, I will be at the Intelligent Speech Conference. This is an annual event with many history podcasters or history-adjacent podcasters presenting on a wide range of topics, and this year's theme is deception. We've got Otto English from the books Fake Heroes and Fake History, the Fake History Hunter podcast, Wesley Livesay from History of the Great War, Robin Jamie from Totalis Rankium, Robin Pearson from History of Byzantium, and many other friends of this show. I will personally be speaking in 4 time slots with topics ranging from Darius the Great to early modern Zoroastrianism, to the people who may or may not have written the books of the Bible. The whole event will be available for rewatch for 1 week after it ends. If you buy your tickets now, go to intelligentspeechonline.com and tune in this Saturday, February 8th at 10 a.m. U.S. Eastern Time. Again, that is intelligentspeechonline.com for this coming Saturday. I hope we see you there.
Big shout out to you for making it through the hectic holiday season. This new year, get clean, quality, pregnancy nutrient support off your to-do list, including Ritual's best-selling essential prenatal multivitamin, designed with 12 traceable key ingredients to support a healthy pregnancy. With big changes coming up, take the small steps now and start today with 30% off a 3-month supply at ritual.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.